This episode and the next few episodes are kindly sponsored by the human rights team at Lee Day & Co Solicitors. Hello and welcome to the Better Human podcast. My name is Adam Wagner and I'm a barrister specialising in human rights. And this podcast is all about human rights. Today I'm delighted to be joined by Billy Bragg, a musician, a thinker and an activist. And he has a new book out called The Three Dimensions of Freedom. And I thought it'd be interesting to have him on to discuss it. And it's a great discussion. The Better Human podcast is kindly supported by Goldsmiths Law and their pioneering new LLB undergraduate course taught in London. You can learn more at gold.act.uk/law. If you find the podcast interesting, then please consider supporting it via Patreon, patreon.com/betterhuman. And just a couple of pounds a month would help make this podcast sustainable and make sure we can carry on doing interesting interviews about human rights. If you want to contact me, you can on adam@betterhumanpodcast.com, and you can follow us on Twitter @BeHumanPodcast. So, Billy Bragg, thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Good to be here, Adam.
We're going to talk about your new book, The Three Dimensions of Freedom, which is, I guess, something between a pamphlet, a polemic, a philosophical treatise. What led you to write it?
I love starting an argument, Adam. That's partly why I'm here. So, Bertolt Brecht said that art is not a mirror with which to reflect society, but a hammer with which to shape it. And each artist chooses their own hammer. Mine happens to be songwriting. But all of us, in order to shape the world, anyone who's tried to shape anything with a hammer will know that you need a sturdy anvil on which to make that thing into the shape you want it. And I would argue that the anvil that we use when we're trying to shape the world, the anvil is accountability. We're trying to call out injustice. We're trying to highlight hypocrisy. We're trying to get some solidarity behind an idea to build a wave among our listeners that can lead to genuine change, because art can't change the world. Music can't change the world. That's a lovely idea. But the people who came up with it smoked a lot of dope. And sadly, they weren't really as focused as they could be. And after 35 years of trying, I have to tell your listeners that the world doesn't change through singing songs. It changes through people taking action, and my job is to try and inspire my audience to engage in the world in whatever way that they can. So accountability has always been a very big issue to me. I was an original signatory of Charter 88 back in the old days. I got heavily involved in New Labour's plans to reform the House of Lords in the light of the Wakeham Commission. It's always been on my radar. And over the last couple of years with the arrival of Donald Trump, that lack of accountability is sadly now like a house on fire. And those of us who are concerned about those things need to up our game, because the urge to just stay in bed and pull the duvet over your head is sometimes overpowering. So instead of just carrying on writing songs about it, I decided to write this. It's a short book. My book before was 120,000 words about skiffle. So this was a little bit more. I was trying to write something in the spirit of Thomas Paine. One of my favorite polemicists is George Orwell. He wrote a book called The Lion and the Unicorn, a very similar short polemical book in 1940. So with that in mind. And the thing about Orwell's book and Paine's book is that they are very much their own personal feelings. They're not constantly referring back to Aristotle and such points. They're trying to articulate something in the here and now, at this moment, rather than relying on what's gone before. I assume that people understand that. So it's a very personal view.
Yeah, and I mean, I would also say that lawyers and law can't change the world either, and it's only really,
we all have a role to play. I think we'll have a role to play, Adam, but ultimately it's down to the mass of people.
It's the social movements.
That
make the change.
Yeah, and we're at kind of either ends of that process. Yeah. I'm at the stirring up end. You're at the legislative end, making it into law. We have our role to play, but without those people in between, you're not going around listening to my records and thinking what cases to take to court. It's the people out there. They really have the power. And part of my job is to try and get my audience to understand that, and not to imagine that just by coming to my gig and singing my songs, they've done their bit. You know, people hate it when you say music can't change the world. They hate it because they know that music moves them emotionally. And I'm totally into that. I get, you know, when I come off stage, people singing Power in a Union, which is usually what I close with, everyone's got their fists in the air. My activism is right charged, right up, 100%. But my job is to make the audience go, I'm feeling like that. But they're fired up as well, so that they're, you know, re-engaged. Because our biggest enemy out there, those of us who want to change the world, isn't capitalism or conservatism, it's cynicism. And that's our challenge, how we overcome our own cynicism. Because, you know, the Daily Mail, Rupert Murdoch, they want you to think that nobody cares about this shit. They want you to think you're on your own. They want you to think that none of this will happen. And we have to overcome that. And one of the ways of doing that is coming in a room with a load of people who are expressing their solidarity with an idea, like there is power in a union. And I draw from that, and I hope the audience draw from that and take that home. And then when you know it doesn't change the world yourself, you think to yourself, well, what more can I do? Can I do more to push forward these ideas? And the book is a manifestation of that.
So you've got the book's called The Three Dimensions of Freedom. So freedom is the overarching idea. And underneath this are three aspects. And the three aspects are liberty, equality, and accountability. And I thought it'd be useful to start where you start, with liberty. And I mean, in one sense, what my reading of this section of the book is that this idea of liberty is really important, but on its own, it goes to bad places. And do you want to just sort of elaborate
on
that?
Yeah, of course, yeah. I mean, liberty is absolutely the bedrock of freedom. The right to express your opinion, the right to behave in a way that, you know, without anyone having control over you. These are, you know, if that is not present, then there really is no real concept of freedom. However, everybody has that right. So whilst liberty empowers you to express yourself, you also have a reciprocal responsibility to respect the freedom of others. And that's where equality comes in. So that kind of sense of respect for other people is absolutely crucial to a free society. And I would argue that liberty without equality is nothing more than privilege. If you can just say whatever you want with no respect for anybody else and no comeback, that's not liberty. That's Donald Trump's Twitter feed. And Trump, in his constant barrage of Twitter, is really proof that liberty and freedom are not the same thing.
Trump opens the book, right?
Of course. I probably wouldn't have written the book if it wasn't for Trump, because he's out there all the time. People can see him. He's like a lightning rod for these kind of debates.
Well, I mean, I read this and then I got the audio book, so I wanted to hear you reading it, which I really recommend. And when it opens, I heard the audio book before I read it. And when it opened, and the quote is, "When you're a star, they let you do it. You can do anything." Yeah. And I forgot that was Trump. I thought, is that Billy Bragg saying that? You know, because it could be any
yeah, of course,
you could
yeah.
take it from
yeah.
any artist.
Yeah, of course.
But it's Donald Trump, and then followed by Tony Benn, which is a great quote. "If one meets a powerful person, ask them five questions. What power have you got? Where did you get it from? In whose interest do you exercise it? To whom are you accountable? And can we get rid of you?" And it's those two.
Different perspectives.
Beacons.
Yeah.
In different parts of the book. And I guess, and I think it seems like Trump for you is this, it epitomizes liberty without equality and accountability.
Yeah, exactly.
He is. And you talk about agency quite a lot.
Yes.
In terms of liberty. And can you explain what you mean by liberty and agency being the same thing?
Well, I don't think that they're the same thing. I wouldn't argue that liberty and agency are the same thing. But I would argue that liberty without accountability leaves us in a situation where we feel that we are free, but we don't actually have any agency over our lives. Part of the book is a critique of neoliberalism, the idea that the market has the answer to all of our problems, social problems, economic problems, even sometimes spiritual problems. And that, of course, is, you know, when a government minister says, as I heard one say in front of me on a TV program, and I was waiting to go on and play a song, when asked, this is a conservative minister, asked by Andrew Neil whether or not they would thinking about putting up a children's allowance. And he said, we'll have to see what the markets think about that. And I don't remember voting for no markets. You know, I don't remember. That's a way of shirking the accountability. So I'm trying to focus on where I see the problem that we face today. And I would argue that many people no longer feel that democracy represents their views. Let's take, for example, it's, you know, that's absolutely clear with in the United States with Trump. His voters don't feel their voices heard in Washington, D.C. I would argue that a lot of the Brexit vote was actually people angry about Westminster and feeling that their voice is not heard. The Gilets Jaunes in France are on the streets still because they feel President Macron doesn't reflect their views. In Germany, they have elections, but the two supposedly opposed parties, the CDU and the SPD, go back into a grand coalition. It's like we have an election here and Labour and Conservatives get into power. So we have another election and whatever the result, they get back into power again. It's democracy and accountability are not synonymous. Their relationship is more like a Venn diagram. And at times of consensus in society, there's a lot of overlap. But at the moment, there isn't much overlap. And as a result of that, people no longer feel they have control over their lives. And that's a very dangerous time because I think when people feel that they have some agency, they can see a better future for themselves and their children, they're willing to work collectively to achieve that better future. But when they feel they have no agency, when they feel they're being ignored, that's when they start to turn inward and that's when they start to see their neighbours as competitors and incomers as the enemy. And so, you know, particularly in our situation in the UK, where we have asymmetric devolution, where people in England don't have that extra layer of representation based on proportional representation, which means that everyone's vote counts. When you don't have that, then the matchup between accountability and democracy is starting to drift apart. So I'm talking about agency in the book as accountability, equality and liberty being the remedy to that sense of helplessness, that sense of not feeling those people's voices heard. Greater accountability, I believe, addresses that problem. It may not solve it, but I'm not here to offer solutions. I'm here to offer suggestions that provide a foundation to build on that more cohesive society based on respect, responsibility, and most importantly of all, reason.
And neoliberalism, in the first section about liberty, and you talk quite a lot of Hayek and Ayn Rand, yeah, and Thatcher and Reagan. And I think your diagnosis of what neoliberalism is, it's often used in different ways, yeah, neoliberalism, is a society where the market has been allowed to dominate in such a way that the kind of hierarchies are very vertical.
Yeah.
So and that's where agency is given to the business leaders and the politicians and the markets, but then you have this opposite effect, yeah, of everybody else. Agency is either taken away, yeah, or people feel it's been taken away.
Yeah.
But either way, it leads to a kind of political nastiness or a culture of, yeah, people feeling that they don't have control.
Yeah,
and that kind of, it gets expressed in lots of ways which are, yeah, quite negative.
Yeah, look what happened in 2008. You know, neoliberalism led us, you know, almost to economic catastrophe. Who paid the price of that? It wasn't the bankers. It wasn't the people who got us into that trouble. It was the ordinary working people who paid the price through austerity. Because what happened was the people in control at the time stepped back and said, well, you know, we've got to make our economy like your domestic economy. We've got to make the books balance. Countries don't do that. That's not how the modern economy works anymore. You know, that Thatcherite idea that everything is about profit and loss. That's not how you can run a society. There have to be deeper values than that. So in terms of bringing greater accountability, I think that's the place where you have to start, you know, because recently there's been some polls done where people have been asked to choose between freedom and security. And most people have understandably gone for security. And some people have interpreted that as meaning a bigger army and more police on the streets. But if you actually look at the details, the security they're talking about is the security of job, the security of tenure, security of a decent health service. That's the kind of security that people want. And a free market that is deregulated to the extent where, you know, companies can become too big to fail, that's very, very dangerous. You know, the adherents of Adam Smith, who I talk a little bit about in the book, who believe there is an invisible hand that will deal with the you know, the companies that aren't viable will go down. Well, that's not the way things have happened. Some companies have been too big to fail. That means that free market capitalism no longer works. And it's not an uncommon thing to find. I mean, just recently, the example of Flybe being given a tax holiday. You know, really, Flybe should have gone bust, but people recognise rightly, and I recognise it because I fly out of Exeter, I live down in the West Country, how crucial Flybe is there. So on one hand, you've got neoliberals saying, no, you must never have any nationalisation, you must never have any kind of social funding of business. And on the other hand, doing exactly that, against what you think are their principles. And they're, you know, I've never been a revolutionary. I've never said we should abolish capitalism. But I recognise that, you know, I'm happy to recognise that if, you know, capitalism in a sense is a bit like fire. If you tend it, it will give you heat and light. But if you let it go where it wants to go, it will consume everything in its path. And I think we've had that proven almost to the point of destruction since the last 40 years since Thatcher and Reagan and the ideas of Friedrich Hayek, which I outline in my book, have been in control.
I mean, it does come through that you're not recommending a kind of upheaval of the entire system, because you actually look backwards to the 1950s, and that looms quite large in a few different sections of the book. And we'll come later to the European Convention on Human Rights and the way that you talk about that. But it seems from my reading that what you're really saying is it's not that capitalism in itself is an evil. It's unregulated capitalism or untrammeled capitalism, and that there will always be that the story you tell about the way that the Hayek, the Free Market Institute and the different organizations that came about in the 60s and 70s to impose or to implement Hayek's ideas, that there will always be these countercurrents of the most free market capitalists attempting to increase the freedom of the markets and their freedom. But if you allow that to happen, I think is what you're saying, then you don't keep that in check, then you will lead to two free markets where the bottom end becomes further down and becomes more oppressed.
Yeah, Hayek's idea of liberty is the freedom to exploit with no regulation whatsoever.
Which wasn't Adam Smith or Keynes's.
No, not at all. Definitely not Adam Smith. Yeah. No. So it's a perversion, really, of what Smith was talking about. But that idea that any regulation is bad underpins the argument for leaving the European Union. You know, the idea that red tape from Brussels has held the country back has been absolutely key to their arguments. Whereas, you know, many ordinary working people, red tape is one person's red tape is the other person's health and safety regulations.
Or maternity rights.
Yeah, exactly, or having a weekend. And so that their whole argument by trying to bring it down to regulations, they are once again making more space for people to be more exploited. You know, you go abroad, even in the United States of America, people have never heard of 0 hours contracts. And when you explain it to them, they can't believe it. Now, if the Americans, of all people, you know, you expect that when you go to Germany or Scandinavia, people be like, oh, that's terrible. You explain it to Americans, they're like, you're kidding me. So that's the problem. This is a reversal. This is going back to the, you know, my great-grandfather was a docker in the London docks, and they had a situation there where men would assemble outside the gates every day, and a bloke would come out and, you know, point to a few people and they'd get work and the rest of them would get nothing. We shouldn't be going back to those days. We should be going in the opposite direction.
Well, no, it's an app that tells
you. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Instead of the guy pointing the finger, it's just an app.
Yeah, still someone somewhere is making those choices.
It's an algorithm.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's the other reason. I mean,
and
you know.
You talk about algorithms.
I do, because I think they're also part of the problem. You know, whoever programs the algorithm obviously has their own inherent biases, whichever way they are. And we need to be talking about how we deal with those problems as well, because when the computer says no now, You know, that's no longer a joke. That's an absolute serious knockback on your prospects of prosperity.
You finish off the Liberty section talking about China, which I found really interesting and I think very current. Because I think the reason you talk about it is because I'll just read a section, the bit that I was thinking of. While maintaining the veneer of Maoist ideology, the Chinese Communist Party has developed a command economy geared towards consumerism. In the late 1980s, its stated aim was to make China a semi-industrialized country. Now it claims that China will be fully developed nation by that date. It already outstrips the world in terms of manufacturing and exports. And yet, it's done it. It's done all this without, I guess it's done liberty, but it has
Hayek's definition of liberty.
Yeah, but that's fascinating because that's come out of a communist ideology where you would have thought equality would be the central.
This is one of the one of the biggest problems about neoliberalism is what we refer to in the book as TINA. The idea that there is no alternative to free market capitalism. Well,
and that was Thatcher's.
Yeah, Chairman Xi has proved that wrong, you know. And what's dangerous about that is that, for better or for worse, when Western governments have gone into developing countries, they've sent in money and support, but they've also demanded that there should be human rights enacted, and they ask governments there to be more respectful of human rights. Well, the Chinese don't really care about that. They'll come and build you a football stadium for nothing, like they were doing in Africa during the Africa Cup of Nations. You don't ask you at all. So if you're a despot in some country anywhere in the world and you need funding and you look to the West and they're saying, yeah, I'll give you some funding, but you've got to have freedom of speech and free press, you look to China and they say, oh, well, we don't really care about that. You know, just we'll just give you the money. That's much, you know, that then makes the Chinese model of capitalism, the authoritarian capitalism, the hegemonic model, which so our idea that we can come in with all the answers, we suddenly find ourselves at not just a social disadvantage, but probably an economic disadvantage because we're wedded to civil liberties. So then the question then becomes, do we in the West become more authoritarian? And I think in Donald Trump, you can see that the answer to that is probably yeah.
But in the 80s and the 90s, at the end of the Cold War, the idea that people grabbed onto was that liberalism and capitalism had to come together.
Mm.
So you couldn't have one without the other. You can't have a successful capitalist economy without some element of a free middle class. That was the basic idea.
Yeah.
And it does seem like China and we've got the most shocking example, I think, recently is the Uyghur Muslims. Yeah,
indeed.
And the fact they've got, you know, millions Uyghur Muslims living in concentration camps, sort of re-education camps.
Yeah.
And there it is. And, and nobody can
And everyone's trading with them. Yeah, exactly.
Because
everyone's
trading with them. They're too big to stop trading with them. Trump is not interested in human rights as an international trading concept. It doesn't matter to
him. No bottom line in it.
There's no bottom line in it. So that's the new world order.
Yeah.
And that is very
It's a shock, isn't it?
But it is troubling.
And that's because, there are certain elements within American academia who have a kind of Hollywood view of history, that it always, that there's always going to be a happy ending. But one of the great tragic things that we know from history is that happy endings aren't guaranteed. On a number of occasions, we've come to situations where, people have believed that there's think about the Daily Mail supporting Hitler, a new way to deal with these economic problems. There's no guarantee that these things will work out in a positive way in the end. So we have to be very, very careful. And when those things begin to slide, when liberty is held up and people say, oh, we have free elections, Putin has free elections. Doesn't mean there's accountability in his country,
relatively.
Yeah, but they have a constitution. These things don't guarantee that people have the agency that I was talking about. So it's very important that we have a much more focused principle rather than just democracy, because that we've seen how that can be exploited in the most negative terms. Accountability, I think, is a much more powerful idea, and they don't always, as I say, they're not synonymous. You shouldn't expect them to be synonymous.
The Better Human podcast is supported by your contributions. If you find it useful and interesting, I would really appreciate if you consider giving just $3 a month, that's just over £2, via our Patreon, that's patreon.com/betterhuman. And if a couple of hundred people do that, then that will make the podcast sustainable and I can carry on interviewing interesting guests about fascinating human rights subjects. Let's move on to equality, which is the second concept, the second part of freedom. And I think you define it as the responsibility to reciprocate the liberties we enjoy.
Yeah.
So reciprocal, it's reciprocal.
It is, yeah.
And we have to share liberties. But you also, it really seems to focus on freedom of speech.
Yeah.
Your idea of equality, which I found really interesting. Can you just explain why?
Well, why in the context of the book is that whilst making a point about basic fundamental rights, a critique of neoliberalism, an analysis of the way the world is drifting, I'm also trying to write about people's actual lived experience. And for many people in our time, the place that they run up against the question of liberty is in social media discourse. They're online, they're talking to someone, and all of a sudden they find themselves, in an argument, being beaten up. You know, the terrible curse of Twitter is that perception always trumps intention. Anyone who doesn't understand that shouldn't really go down.
I bear the scars. All of us do. Absolutely.
So you know that is where most people encounter the arguments around the notion of liberty. To be able to say there is a breed of what they refer to in the United States of America, free speech warriors. People like, for our audience in the domestic audience, someone like Rod Liddell, and the writing in the Spectator. A provocateur, someone who's, coming up with clickbait. Piers Morgan would be another person, outraged at the prospect of a vegan sausage roll can send him into apoplexy.
Or manufactured apoplexy.
Yeah, well, that's the whole thing. I mean, what political correctness, arguments about political correctness are manufactured apoplexy. There is no such thing as political correctness. It doesn't exist. There's no political party putting it forward as a program. There's no people marching on the streets demanding it. There's no intellectuals in Chicago writing huge, essays about it. I believe it's a trope that is used by reactionaries to police the limits of social change. And I think that's where the battle is in terms of equality at the moment. The right of people to express their views is sacrosanct, but the right of others to challenge them is also sacrosanct. And so often, people like Rod Liddell, their anger is all around the fact that they're being challenged for what they're saying. You know, you can't say these kind of things. I mean, I had a right run-in last year with Morrissey and his followers over stuff that he posted on his website with regard to Stormzy's appearance at Glastonbury Festival Headline. He cut and pasted a far right, a racist website that talks about the Great Replacement Theory, and just slapped it in there in the middle of, And I waited for a week for someone in the music press to pick up on this. Nothing at all. So I just wrote a long Facebook post about it. And really, what I was saying was, Morrissey has a right to do this, and I respect his right to do that, if that's what he wants to do. But he doesn't have a right to do it without being challenged. He doesn't have a right to do it with no comeback. And that's what equality is about, I think. It's about recognizing that others have rights. You can't expect to make your statement and not be challenged by it. That works on a number of different levels. That on one hand, you can have a debate with someone online in deliberation. And on the other hand, you can find yourself being, having a pylon and being the focus of a online campaign, which is never nice. So you've got to be really clear when you're you know, making statements, particularly contentious statements, that you're absolutely clear about what you're saying. And when someone makes a statement in those terms, you've got to be able to, yourself as the recipient of that, you've got to be able to respect their right to say that, but also have, you know, hold them to account for what they're saying. And that's where people don't like being taken to task. They don't like the accountability bit. And that's what worries me, because if you have liberty without equality, that's just privilege. That's clearly what it is. You can just say whatever you want, whenever you... But if you have liberty and equality but without accountability, that just allows everyone to be an arsehole. That just allows everyone to have a pile on. Accountability is what gives freedom its teeth. It's what gives freedom it's what creates a space within freedom to deliberate ideas. If you ignore accountability, it's very dangerous territory, because I think that liberty without accountability is the most dangerous type of freedom of all, and that's impunity. And when people argue about freedom of speech, when they're saying, they're complaining about being challenged, that's not a defense of freedom of speech, that's a defense of impunity. And we live in very dangerous times, because the President of the United States is a man who's lived all his life with impunity. And sadly, I'm sorry to say, the Prime Minister of Great Britain is also a man who's never been held responsible for what he's done in his political life, his professional life, or his private life.
No, he's been elected Prime Minister.
Been elected Prime Minister. He's said so many awful things he said. But to me, the most troubling was when he said, I am pro having my cake and pro eating it, because that's the statement of a man who believes that he has a right to both make the rules and break them whenever it suits him. And that's a very dangerous place to be when someone's in charge of a country, as you can see from Vladimir Putin.
Just coming back to this idea of accountability, there's two different locations for accountability, I think, in the book. There's the accountability, institutional accountability, so that's regulation of companies, democracy, you know, democratic institutions. And then there's individual accountability. Yep. And there's a lot. You're quite heavily focused on speech and this sort of marketplace of ideas kind of idea. And my guess, and correct me if I'm wrong, is your life as an artist.
Yeah.
That is where you exist in the world of ideas and expression and counter-expression and that. But it isn't the individual accountability that you're talking about also responsibility and that kind of, you do refer to Tony Blair talking about human rights being about responsibility. And I guess you seem to slightly bridle at that. But isn't that what you're really talking about? People taking responsibility for what they say?
I think responsibility and accountability are two different things. In the way that we refer to responsibility, we take it as an individual, as I take this glass from the table, I take it. But we hold someone to account. And holding someone implies there's a third party involved in this, that you, from that side of the table, you hold me to account. So, yeah, I can be responsible for my behavior. But when that's the only limit on my behavior is my sense of responsibility, that's dangerous. I don't trust that. Boris Johnson.
What right do I have to hold you to account, just as an individual in the world?
Well, in terms of what I say and expressing my opinion, you have a right to question what I have to say. You have a right to hold me to account, whether it's here in this setting here, on social media, what I've said in the newspaper. But also, beyond that, there are laws that you can call upon to hold me to account. And there are social mores that social mores that you can use to hold me to account. There are limits to that. We know, we have... Within our society, we have lines that we tend not to trust. They're moving all the time, those lines, and you have to up your sensibility. The debate within the Labour Party about the problem that they have with anti-Semitism has caused a lot of us to rethink how we address that issue and some of the language that we use, some of the phrases that previously we've thought of are acceptable, clearly in the new debate aren't acceptable, and we've had to revise that thought. Some people bridle at that. Some people don't want to change their attitude. They don't want to accept that the other person has the right to say that this behaviour is no longer acceptable. They're not willing to see that other perspective, particularly the perspective of the victim. You know, there's a clear example of that on Question Time last week, where a woman of colour who was making the point about racism with regard to the treatment of Meghan Markle, and a white man said there is no racism. That, you know, to me, that's an expression of white male privilege. You know, he has a right to argue whether or not Meghan Markle was treated racist, but he doesn't have a right to say it doesn't exist. He doesn't have a right to deny the experience of a victim.
It was a power play from him, really, is my reading of it, as well as being privileged. It's somebody, the classic example of the person in the privileged position exposing their own power and wielding their own power over that other person. And we see that a lot in these kind of debates.
I wish this wasn't so, Adam, but we have imported the American notion of the culture war. And I think the culture war is a manifestation of lack of agency. For people who no longer feel their voices heard in Westminster or in Washington, no longer feel they have control over the economic situation that they face, to offer them a tool by which to gainsay people they disagree with, and that tool would be something like the notion of political correctness. If they feel they can win those culture war arguments, they feel they have some kind of little power, but it's insidious because it's people in power who actually have the power to make a difference are deflecting anger away from them onto a minority, so that the minority get the blame for the situation, where it's actually the people in power, whether it's political power or corporate power, that are to blame for the lack of agency and the economic situation that these bereft individuals find themselves in. So that culture war aspect, and we saw it starkly in that exchange on Question Time, is unfortunately the currency of debate around freedom in this country at the moment.
And that I think is, from my reading, at the heart of your equality section, is this idea that that there will always be a backlash against a change in social attitudes. That's as night follows day. That because as soon as you not attempt, if you bring down a hierarchy, the people who are high in the hierarchy will either consciously or unconsciously react against that, because who wants to be brought down, especially if they are just there. Yeah. They haven't done anything to be there. It's just the way they were born.
Yeah.
But all of a sudden they feel that they're being brought down, or they're being replaced. That white replacement theory. That psychologically is, and I'm not saying that's what's happening. I don't believe in that concept. I think human rights is much more about expanding the who is included in society. It's not about replacement or hierarchies. It's really not. But that psychological, the feeling of being brought down, the feeling of being replaced, is so strong that it creates these kind of backlashes.
Yeah, and when you look at the dynamic political movements of the 21st century, you know, Me Too, Black Lives Matter, Extinction Rebellion, they're all accountability movements. They're all about holding people in positions of power, white men, exploiting the environment, to power. You know, they've risen up as a manifestation of where the power lies. And for for privileged white men, change is something that happens to somebody else. It's not something that happens to them. So they bridle when they find that. But as I say, more often than not, they're arguing about being held to account rather than arguing about what it is that the issue that's hard. It's all about deflection, political correctness, virtue signaling, now, you know, woke, you know, using that as a pejorative term against people, the woke master general, as they call Ricky Gervais. they're all deflections. They're all ways of deflection, criticism away from themselves, and taking, not dealing with the issue, but dealing with the argument around the issue. And so, you know, I'm trying to give people with the book the tools by which to refocus the argument. In the 20th century, for younger listeners, we had ideology. You know, we all had our own ideology people who were interested in politics, whether it was left or right. And what ideology allowed you to do it, it gave you kind of framework to look at the world so that you could look at an issue and by using your ideological perspectives, work out how you felt about that issue, where you felt the right was. And that was kind of useful because it was relatively quick and relatively straightforward. We live in a post-ideological world now. So all these debates are going on without any parameters. And what I'm trying to do with the book is suggest that there are parameters that we can have that allow us to bring our sensibilities to focus on an issue, whether it's a political issue or whether it's that person that you don't know who they are, anonymous person you're talking to in social media. You know, these ideas work if you're trying to deal with something like Donald Trump. But also, if you're looking at this person who's arguing with you, they have their liberty, that's clear. Do they respect my equal right to express my opinion? Or are they shouting me down and not listening to, you know, listening to my point and responding? You know, are they not responding respectfully to my point? And secondly, if I question them, do they just suddenly attack me, you know, ad hominem attack? Are they willing to make themselves accountable? Because the thing about accountability, and I think this is what's special about it, is whereas liberty empowers you to express your opinion, equality requires you to reciprocate that. Well, accountability, you both have the right to hold others to account, but you have to make yourself accountable as well. So it is both empowering in the first instance, but also reciprocal as well, but you have to respect that people are trying to hold you to account here.
And it doesn't work unless you are behaving. And this is something that I try to engage with or to operate on social media, is that it doesn't work unless you are
exactly
yourself behaving
exactly
in that way. Because if you're aggressively attacking somebody,
exactly,
they will reciprocate and they will multiply it
but
by two.
My experience in dealing with that is you find people who are willing to criticize you and be responsible as they're doing it. And with those people, you can actually learn stuff. You can, through deliberation, you can, you know, sharpen your perspective, where there are other people who are clearly just there to kick your ass. And you need to quickly work out which ones. You can't engage with everybody. You can't engage with everybody because it's just impossible. So in that case, you know, when I get into trouble, there's a few people I respect online, yourself being one of them. I've followed you on Twitter. And I know that if I engage with you, you will give me a reasonable perspective back. It may be critical. It may be, painful for me to read. But I respect your integrity, and I know that you're not just going to start, you know, being abusive, because I think liberty gives you the right to express your opinion. It doesn't give you the right to be abusive. That's, for me, the line on that is where attacks become personal. I think everybody has their own line on where that is, but for me, it's when you play the player rather than playing the ball. And I try, it's not easy, I try to play the ball all the time on social media and not play the player. It's tough because when you're on stage and you're having to deal with a heckler quickly, you got to shut them down quickly. You know, if you can get the audience to laugh at them, that usually shuts them up. So that impulse to come straight back with something, you've got to really, it doesn't work on social media. I've got myself in really some real serious punishment beatings from being a smart ass. It's my own fault.
Lots to say about that. No, but thank you. I mean, look, the feeling's mutual.
Appreciate that.
I mean, you seem to have quite a sort of complex relationship with social media, and it comes out in the book. You say, for social media users, the freedom social media offers, and opportunities to act in ways they would never dare contemplate in the real world, face-to-face interactions. And you're particularly worried about anonymity.
Yeah.
Which you say can create an atmosphere where bullying, pylons, and abusive language are never far from the surface, the cloak of invisibility. And I would add to that also going back to the algorithms, particularly on Twitter, that what's now put up at the top of news feeds is the aggressive, outragey stuff.
Yeah.
And it's very rarely the interesting discussions.
No.
So it's this self-perpetuating dynamic. But what do you think can be done about anonymity? Because it seems like when you say, when I say on social media, I think anonymity is a problem. And I've had some serious problems with anonymous accounts.
Yeah.
People say, well, you know, there's a necessity for people to be able to express their views if they work for the government or, you know, they work for...
Well, that's a different thing. We're talking, we're talking about the difference between a whistleblower and a bully. Yeah. You know, if we, you know, if you're in that situation and you need to be able to make a point about something that's terribly wrong, you know, you may have an experience yourself, you know, you may have been, let's say, sexually abused, and you want to talk about it and you don't want people to know who you are. Well, there should be space for that. What there shouldn't be space for is someone who's been banned from Twitter to just pick another name and go back on again. That's what I'm talking about. That's where
I've got someone who's set up more than 50
accounts
just to reply to me.
Really, I'm not surprised. You know, there's a word for people like that. You know, they're stalkers. They're not really, I mean, I've had a few people like that as well. And I don't like blocking people because I feel that's a failure of accountability. But I know there are people who are just coming into my feeds to pick a fight with me. So I just quietly mute them and I don't have to look at what they've got to say as well. Because they've made their point and I've engaged with them with their point. Generally, they come back the next day, same point. No matter what I'm talking about, I can be talking about something like, you know, what a lovely day it is today is a picture of the sun, you know, the sunset today. And in they come and put the boot in about some really, really contentious issue. And, you know, it's like you can't have a discussion about racism anymore without angry men coming on and talking about the terrible victims of abuse in places like Rochdale. And that's, you know, that's those victims are you know, what happened, if there really were. And you know, the reports from last week of the idea that there were 1,400 young women who were failed by the police. That is utterly appalling. And of course, I'm totally opposed to that. But, you know, for angry white men to use that as a, you know, to hide behind those women as a way of avoiding being held to account for, you know, racist views that have been expressed by someone else, I find that a little bit troubling. So that, you know, and the other side of that is, if you actually get onto a troll sometimes, and I've done this a few times, they turn out to be quite reasonable people. And they're like, you know, well, I'm sorry, I didn't really mean to, you know, so I'm like, oh, it's cool. You know, not all of them, obviously, but some of them I have engaged a little deeper with. And generally, they're just people who have found the power of, you know, having a platform and being able to say something and people liking it. And we all like a bit of that. We all, you know, we all enjoy a bit of that. But they've found that to be incredibly heady, and it's just led them on to say things that they would never, ever say to, not, you know, to anybody, not even to a stranger.
And it happens by increments.
Yes, it does.
Because they get a few likes for a slightly more outrageous thing than they say, and then they try something a bit more outrageous, and then, you know, 10 days later, they're saying things that are miles away from what they would have, anything they would have dreamed of saying.
Or there's a pile on, you know, and they want to feel part of something, so they go in and put the boot in.
And validated and part of a community and that.
That's the worrying thing about social media. I mean, the fact that there's enough people now who believe the earth is flat that they can go on a cruise. You know, that couldn't happen in the old days because they couldn't find each other, people who believe the earth is flat. Now they can. So that's one of the downsides of social media. But social media is just a mirror on humanity. Everything is there. All the best things are there. I mean, you know, I've read among my followers, there's a little group who call themselves the Saddos, and they have their own Facebook page. And to see them respond to someone who's going through emotional turmoil, if someone loses a friend, a partner, a child, I'm so proud of them. They are so supportive of one another. And they're giving support to individuals who may feel isolated in their social situation. That's an incredible, valuable resource. So we can't just dismiss the idea of social media. We can't say it's a curse on society. But we do have to be aware that when we go there are different rules that apply. And there are elephant traps that we can easily fall into. And there are troubling misconceptions that the things that we say can be easily taken completely out of context.
Isn't it another free market that needs regulation?
Yeah, exactly. It does need regulation.
And without regulation, it can go in directions that it's the fire that's let to, to burn out.
100%. But like that, regulation has to be self-regulation. So how do you do that? You know, you need principles, you need parameters. The reason I called the book The Three Dimensions of Freedom rather than The Three Pillars of Freedom is that I wanted to put forward the idea of creating a space that is safe. I know that can be a bit of a trigger word for some people, the idea of safe space. But the notion of the safe space is not a place where people are banned from expressing their opinions. It's a place where people's opinions are respected. So if you're a provocateur, like Milo Yiannopoulos, whose whole shtick is clickbait, basically, you know, when you want to go into a place and offend people, that's, you know, I can understand why university campuses say, no, that's not acceptable. If you're going to come in here, we have these house rules, and those house rules are liberty, your right to express an opinion, equality, you have to respect other people's opinion, and accountability, you have to be expect to be held accountable for what you're saying. That, to me, is a practical way of ensuring that deliberation occurs rather than screaming and shouting. And because the thing about our students today is they're all digital natives. They've all seen what can happen if someone expresses an opinion and gets a gang of people behind them. Our generation, if you don't want me saying so, Adam, we didn't really experience that. So to us, a debate, sitting down and having a debate, was merely that. It was a formal occasion often where you sat down and there were certain rules that we accepted. But I think for students now today, the idea of letting someone provocative into their space, they understand the enormity and the forces that can be unleashed by that. So they're bound to want to have house rules, you know. Every pub landlord has rules about who can come and drink in his bar. And if every time you come and you start a fight, you're going to get banned. That's the way things work. You know, there's no law saying about that. But if the landlord wants to have create a place where people, it's conducive to people to come and have a social discourse, then he has to have some rules, has to have some house rules. And safe spaces are merely house rules that ensure everybody gets to express their opinion. And in those areas of very, very high contention, sure, there's bound to be some disagreement. I mean, the arguments currently around transgender rights is incredibly contentious. But, you know, again, that's something that could benefit with a little bit more deliberation. One of my concerns about the debate around Brexit is the lack of nuance involved in it. You know, in the European elections, everybody either voted for no Brexit or revoke Brexit. There was no room for nuance. And if anything is going to halt the complete break and the idea of no Brexit, I think it is nuance. It's the nuance of the Irish border. It's the nuance of the 3.1 million EU citizens who live in the UK and made their lives. It's the nuance of our economic and political relationship with the other 27 nations. But nobody seems to be interested in nuance at all. And I find that very troubling, that everything has become so polarised in the debate that we don't have time to recognise the real detail here. You know, get Brexit done doesn't have much room for the grey vagaries of actually doing Brexit. It's completely polarised. And so really, because of that polarisation, that's why I pitched the book into the social media discourse, because that's where most of the polarisation is happening.
So let's move on to accountability. Let's finish with accountability.
Yep.
And it's quite a sort of rich idea of accountability, I think, that you're proposing. And you start, you put Magna Carta as the opening salvo in history for accountability, this idea that the king is slowly sort of bound. I sometimes think of Magna Carta and that process as like Gulliver being bound by lots and lots of tiny little strings till eventually he can't move, or at least he can't move in the way that he wants. And you've got, you talk about Magna Carta, you talk about 1689 Bill of Rights, you move through to the European Convention and the Human Rights Act. And those two, I mean, I like that section of the book, obviously, because that's where the laws come in.
Of course, yeah.
But those seem to be the reason you appreciate those bills of rights is, it seems, that they are accountability made into law that can't then be overturned by the majority or by the king or by the ruler.
I mean, I think the history of England hinges on a moment of extreme accountability, the execution of Charles I in January 1649. Before that, law is made by absolute monarchy, by theology, on a hereditary principle. After that, the seeds of deliberation and ultimately democracy are planted in English politics. And I say England because I think that as a progressive patriot, which is how I define myself, what that means is that rather than feeling strongly about symbols and institutions and the idea of assimilation to a single idea of what England is, as a progressive patriot, I believe in values, and the values that we like to think of ourselves as holding of tolerance, of fairness, are actually rooted in a history of dissent against absolute power. And that's the thread that runs through our history. And the tradition of dissent in English history is as strong as the tradition of aristocracy, monarchical power, the whole idea of empire, the things that are traditionally seen as being the things that people feel patriotic about. There's always been this alternative running, the Chartists, the suffragettes, the corresponding societies, the foundation of the welfare state, Brexit, part of it as well. It's not all one way, that dissenting tradition, I feel very much part of that. And that has always hinged on accountability. The Labour Party is founded by trade unionists who are seeking to hold the employers accountable in the workplace. Socialism is another word for accountability. And because we live in a post-ideological world, words such as socialism come with a lot of baggage, the baggage of totalitarianism. If we want to talk about in broader strokes, as I find myself increasingly doing at gigs and in books, we talk about accountability. Rather than living in a socialist society, we talk about wanting to live in a compassionate society. I find myself talking about these, step back and look at these ideas and try and take the principles that I've always held and articulate them in their most primal form. And accountability in our culture, in English culture, has always been a driving force. And as we move into a time where like it or not, nationalism is coming to the fore again, I think we have to make those alternative traditions visible to ensure that the right, the far right, the racists, the xenophobes don't capture the idea of what England is. Because in some ways, England is, at the moment, for a lot of people, I think, a bit of a blank sheet. And it gives us a space in which to perhaps begin to come to terms with the legacy of the British Empire as a separate thing, in the way the Scots have in the last 40 years. They have somehow managed to re-articulate their national identity in a way that is a lot more inclusive. And at the moment, I think for many people, particularly people of colour, English is a bit of an ethnic identity. It shouldn't be like that. If Englishness is going to be anything, and it may actually be nothing, it may be an intangible thing that doesn't exist, like dark matter. If Englishness is going to mean anything, it surely has to be about place, not race, about where you are rather than where your grandparents are from, about everything that happens within that space that we call England. And from that basis, we can't, if we're going to find a new space, we can't go into that without any knowledge of history whatsoever. Because to do that, we're giving ammunition to those people who have a much narrower definition of what our national identity is. We need to connect with that and say, look, there's a rich tradition here of opposition to absolute power. In the old days, it was the absolute power of the monarchy. In the last 200 years, it's been the absolute power of capitalism. And this is it's the same argument. It's the same challenge. And once it was impossible to conceive of governance without absolute monarchy, and now, for some, it's impossible to conceive of the economy without free market capitalism. It's the same kind of challenge. And I think those resonances are really, really important, rather than just rejecting it, which the left have always had a bit of a tin ear for national identity, apart from Orwell. And so that has to be part of the equation as well, that I draw strength from my dissenting tradition to make these arguments today in a way that I think is as important to me as it is to those people who have a more traditional idea of what patriotism means.
One of the ideas that popped into my head, which I hadn't properly thought of before, but came out of the way that you present your argument, is that the Magna Carta, the Bill of Rights, the European Convention on Human Rights, that these are all in a way market interventions in the same way that, you know, the regulation of the financial markets, that these are, that naturally, if left to our own devices, we are inequality, yeah, hierarchy is where we end up on a social inequality and social hierarchy.
Yeah.
Whereas human rights take an opposite view, which is that we are all fundamentally deserving, or, you know, we inherently have a humanity which has to be respected, and a certain, we need to be allowed to flourish. We can't be discriminated against. We have to be allowed to speak. And that goes back to free speech, speak in the public space,
yeah,
and express ourselves. And that accountability, maybe that's not what you intended, but it seems to come out of it's a regulation of our natural instincts, and which makes us something better as a result. Is that a fair description?
Well, it creates a level playing field. And that's, you know, you can't really prescribe. This isn't a left-wing argument I'm making. It's a universal argument. And the people that I fundamentally disagree with, you know, but to get back to the quote that's attributed to Voltaire, but actually was invented by one of his biographers, I don't agree with what you say, but I'll fight for the death to your right to say it. I mean, that's an expression of a fundamental belief in equality, not fundamental belief in being able to say whatever you want to say. It's all about equality, that. And I think you're right in the sense that I'm not trying to prescribe something here. I'm trying to create that space. I'm trying to offer the foundations on which to build a society based on respect, based on responsibility, based on reasonable deliberation. Those things, it seems to me, are missing. And to get back to what I was saying earlier about Brecht's idea of art as a hammer with which to shape society, part of that process is to talk about things that are missing, to identify things that are not there, that should really be there. And so with the book, I'm trying to draw attention to that ideas that we have hitherto taken for granted, like liberty, like equality, and like accountability, are being diluted by the economic system, but also by an authoritarian tendency that is resisting change by refusing to be held to account. So it's not so much I'm trying to offer the answer to these problems. I'm just trying to create that space, that three-dimensional space, hence the three dimensions of freedom, that three-dimensional space in which we can sit down and talk about these things and find consensus and find a way forward based on that, rather than, for instance, on the referendum, a winner-takes-all answer that you know, has occurred on a tiny majority and has fractured our country. So there's a healing in this book, a suggestion of a healing, an offer for the creation of a space in which we can come together to all of us be heard. You know, a little bit like the idea of the Citizens' Assembly. I'm a big fan of that. I was concerned, although I would like, ultimately, I recognise that the probably the only way we were going to stop Brexit was to have another referendum. I worried that would just be as divisive as the last one, and that I felt that a Citizens' Assembly was a much better way to approach it, because even if the Citizens' Assembly decided we should have another referendum, it would come from a place of consensus. It would come from a place where everybody has been allowed to express their view, because you'd want the Citizens' Assembly to be broadcast live on the internet so everyone could hear that everyone's views were being expressed. Sadly, that hasn't happened. But what is encouraging about the leadership, Labour leadership campaigns, is a number of candidates have spoken about the idea of greater accountability, the idea of using citizens' assemblies, the idea of reforming the House of Lords, the idea of making people's vote count. You know, I was really excited about Clive Lewis as a candidate because he seemed to be talking about those issues, and I was very sorry when he didn't get on the ballot. But now, you know, other people, both, you know, Rebecca Long Bailey, who's allegedly the Corbyn candidate, but also Jess Phillips, who you could argue is more, you know, the opposite end of the spectrum, they're both talking about that. So I'm really interested that the Labour Party might be beginning to grasp that now and understand that in modern politics, accountability is really an issue. It's not a clearly defined single issue, but it's the issue that joins the dots through a number of things that are causing us a lot of problem. And the fundamental problem that's at the bottom of that is the lack of agency that people feel. Accountability is a way of addressing that, but it has to be real. It can't be window dressing. It has to be, let's say, you know, regional assemblies for England with the same powers as Holyrood, a Scottish Parliament, you know, where people really feel that they have some say in their lives, where they really feel that their vote means something, where they really feel that their voice is heard, where everything isn't dominated by what happens in London or by the sheer demographic size of London. You know, that's why I'm not in favour of an English Parliament, because that would just make London even more powerful. You know, we need to break things down, send devolve power away from Westminster. You know, there's even an issue there for having a written constitution. One of the interesting anomalies of our revolution in the 1640s is that it occurred before those concepts of individual rights had developed by an Englishman, Thomas Paine. Wasn't born even then, and others obviously, but that's in part of our tradition as well. And because of that, we have an anomaly where our Bill of Rights is an agreement between Parliament and the Crown. We don't have any documents in our Constitution that begin "We the People," which I think makes it a real problem, because any government with a simple majority in the House of Commons can alter the Constitution. And really, at its heart, a Constitution should be a set of rules by which the people consent to be governed. They shouldn't be the gift or the power to be altered by someone who has a simple majority based on only, you know, a minority of the vote.
And people must need to be able to find them as well.
Yeah,
that's the problem.
Yeah,
I mean, I've spoken about this in another podcast, but I totally agree. I think it is time for some kind of a written constitution.
And the trouble with the Supreme Court at the moment, you know, people arguing with the you know, particularly with the ruling on the prorogation of Parliament, and they're going to want to get rid of it. You know, the Supreme Court are just VAR. You know, they're just much better at working out where the line was, and people hate it. They hate VAR because it's impeding the game, they say. But
they
enjoy
the spectator, the entertainment of
exactly
seeing people making choices on the cuff and doing things quickly.
Detail and nuance are crucial. Whether it's in a sporting competition or whether it's in the laws of the land, and that's why they're getting so much stick, I think, the Supreme Court, because they've been changed from how it used to be within the House of Lords, going in to be something separate. They have become like VAR. You know, they become they're without the game. You know what I mean? They're not sat there in the House of Lords. The VAR ref is not sat there at the match. He's not got the atmosphere. He's not got the crowd baying for him to make the decision they want. He's doing it in isolation. He's looking very much closely at the detail. I have to say I'm a bit ambivalent about VAR.
Yeah.
That's bound to be contentious, particularly in a country without a written constitution. So I think there's grounds to look at that. In some ways, incorporating the European Convention was a cop-out, because I think Parliament always knew if it wanted to, it could leave. And that's where it's come to. And I genuinely fear what the Conservatives might do in trying to write their own Bill of Rights, that it might be something much more, the rights might be limited in some way around certain issues and not universal, because, you know, as I don't have to tell you this kind of thing, or probably not your listeners either, but the most important aspect of the Universal Convention of Human Rights, it's not the rights or the humans or the convention, it's the universal. And, you know, that aspect of it is always going to be contentious.
I think that's a great place to leave. Obviously, I agree.
There's a surprise.
Thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
That's good to talk to you, Adam.
Really interesting.
Thank you very much.
And the book is called The Three Dimensions of Freedom. And yep. It is it's excellent. It's well worth reading. Thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Thanks so much to Billy Bragg for an absolutely fascinating discussion. You can buy his book on Amazon and in all good bookshops, The Three Dimensions of Freedom. Thanks to the podcast editor, Samantha Brough, and the research producer, Natasha Holcroft-Eames. If you want to support the podcast and make sure it's sustainable, please go to our Patreon, patreon.com/betterhuman. You can contact me at adam@betterhumanpodcast.com with suggestions or comments, and you can follow us on Twitter @BeHumanPodcast. I've been Adam Wagner. This has been the Better Human Podcast. See you next time. This episode and the next few episodes are kindly sponsored by the human rights team at Lee Day & Co. Solicitors.
Where the Jub-Jub bird and Shunda Frumious band a snatch. He took his vorpal sword in hand, long time the manxome foe he sought, till rested he by the tum-tum tree and stood a while in thought. And while in uffish thought he stood, the Jabberwock with eyes of flame came whiffling through the tulgey wood and burbled as he came.
Yeah, that's better than what you have for breakfast.
Yeah, I'll get bored of that. And also, it sometimes takes longer than that, you know. And it impresses the shit out of Americans. I think it's Anglo-Saxon.
They think that.
Yeah, they think. Yeah, I always say, it's from, you know, the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, and they're like,
Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. Yeah, whatever that. Yeah. Brilliant.